That's Eric Reed on piano opening up Ahmad's Blues, composed by the great one himself, Ahmad Jamal. It's from Eric's 1995 Motown recording, The Swing and I. Ben Wolf on bass, Gregory Hutchinson on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and much to discuss today as we focus on Haiti. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who for 6 years stonewalled Haitians' claims that poor sanitation practices of UN-supervised troops stationed in Haiti after the devastating 2010 earthquake caused a cholera epidemic that has left 10,000 dead and 800,000 infected, now admits responsibility. Not totally, partially. As an official statement released on August the 19th suggests, we're lucky to have with us veteran journalist and documentarian Kim Ives, editor of Haiti Liberté, and who has served as our correspondent on Haiti, discussing Ban Ki-moon's stonewalling on this critical issue, and the impact it continues to have not only on Haiti, but the rest of the world. And it's great to have you once again with us, Kim. Welcome. Thanks a lot. Okay, so the Secretary General says on Friday, well, yes, sort of, kind of, we are responsible. How did this come about? What do you learn about the behind-the-scenes pressures that brought at least this admission 6 years down the road?
Well, yeah, as you say, he has only sort of kind of accepted responsibility, but report of a special United Nations rapporteur has established without any question the UN responsibility for the outbreak. This was written by a lawyer, a New York University law professor, Philip Alston, who wrote this absolutely hard-hitting and pulls absolutely no punches in reporting to the Secretary General that the UN has a policy that he calls morally reprehensible, legally indefensible, and politically self-defeating. And the Secretary General has so far simply said we're going to own up to our own responsibility without clearly defining what that is. So this report was released on the same day held previously a year ago a lower trial court that the UN has immunity in this case. And in fact, if you look on the UN's website and you see the statement that is attributable to the spokesman for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, whose term ends this year, and this, as we'll see, I think may have a big role in what's happening here. In that statement, they don't say anything about the revelation. Now, I think it's unthinkable, really, that it's a pure coincidence that the appeals decision to continue granting the United Nations immunity from prosecution for bringing cholera into Haiti is that on the same day that possibly Philip Alston himself or somebody else in the United Nations leaked this report to Jonathan Katz, who used to be the AP reporter for the reporter for in Haiti, and he published the revelation in the New York Times. But there's been a huge outcry within the UN ranks of the UN itself, saying, how is it possible that we're taking no responsibility and claiming immunity after importing cholera into his report that it was indeed Nepalese soldiers in October 2010 who let the sewage from their outhouses flow into the headwaters of Haiti's largest river, the Artibonite River, which is used for bathing, for washing, for irrigating, and it spread like wildfire through Haiti because, in part, in the days when everybody said this base has caused this, the UN was saying, no, 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 this is something that has nothing to do with our troops and with our deployment of 9,000 troops in Haiti as an occupation force. And precisely their foot dragging, I remember I was in Haiti in October 2010, and I was speaking to a Cuban doctor. And the Cubans, Utrice, had been on the front lines of fighting cholera in Africa, for example. And when they got there, when they got to Africa, they found ways to close the spread of cholera. And he said, "What they're doing in Haiti, they're doing everything wrong. They're not keeping the people who have cholera moving outside of the area, which was the Artibonite, and eventually the cholera spread throughout the country. And now Haiti has the largest epidemic in the world." So, in short, this is a huge development that finally we see the possibility that the UN will have to accept responsibility and, this is the key, and pay reparations to the victims of cholera. And as you pointed out, there are officially about 9,000 to 10,000 people who have died from cholera, and about 800,000. But the real figures are, in fact, surely much higher because so many of the cases of cholera are not reported in Haiti.
Well, could you take us back into Haiti at the time that this was the dominant concern, as it has been since the earthquake and the introduction of the UN-supervised peacekeeping forces after the earthquake? What was what was the reaction when people began to get sick, and the people themselves pointed out where the problem was, but nobody was listening?
Exactly. There were demonstrations. And in fact, in the New York Times piece that came out last Thursday, they have a picture of one of the demonstrations in late October 2010. This is about 2 weeks after the first case had come. We're marching on the UN base in Mirabalé, which is on the central plateau in Haiti, who were marching on the Nepalese base to say, you have caused this cholera outbreak. And the UN, basically, this is outlined in Alston's report, which came out this past weekend in the New York Times Magazine. If you go online, you can read the report of Alston. And he said, the UN essentially stonewalled, did everything to deny, not only deny their responsibility, but to somehow attack the people who were accusing them and saying that they were trying to create problems where there were none, and essentially were urging people to leave behind. It doesn't really matter how this cholera outbreak started, let's deal with it. But of course, it does hugely matter how it started. And it has recently been learned that even since the outbreak of cholera, they've been continuing the same policies. So in Africa, in Sudan, in other countries where UN are deployed, there have been a similar sanitation negligence, which has led to possibly the outbreak of disease in other scenarios. This is a worldwide problem, which first came to light in Haiti. And the Haitians, as to return to where we started, stood up immediately, and they immediately pointed the finger at the UN, but the UN totally dismissed it and said that it was not theirs. And I even recall hearing, for instance, National Public Radio, NPR, some crazy reports of people saying that this was a sort of a homegrown, it's not really clear that this be South Asian strain of cholera, when it was totally clear. It was established by at least seven different medical inquiries, two of them sponsored by the UN itself, that it had to have been this Nepalese base. And here they were sending out false reports through state media, NPR, to try to convince people that somehow this was organically generated and there was doubt about whether it was from the UN base. No, it was from the UN. Only now, 6 years later, are they admitting it.
Well, the cholera epidemic was also a factor because, it compounded the misery that the Haitians were already experiencing as a result of that 7.0 magnitude earthquake that destroyed so many homes and killed so many and had so many people basically lost. We know that there had been international efforts at rebuilding. Most notably, you have discussed here at length the Clinton Global Initiative. How did this epidemic factor into the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton initiatives and its various affiliated organizations in, quote, raising money for the relief of cholera victims?
Obviously, Haiti was still reeling from that 2010 earthquake. And one of the things he points out, Alston, in his report, is that the UN tried to use the earthquake to somehow suggest, and this was also in that NPR story I was just mentioning, to somehow suggest that there was a link somewhere between the earthquake and the appearance of cholera. They tried to use the earthquake as a cover for the emergence of cholera, and actually to blame Haiti for its sanitation shortfalls, the fact that there was a lack of good sewers and drinking water systems in Haiti, because this, the listeners, Utrice, they should understand that any talk of vaccines, et cetera, this is foolishness, nonsense to talk about that. This is not a virus. This is a bacteria that is spread through having the water you drink too close to the water where your fecal matter ends up. So the whole point is keeping those two things separate. And sanitation systems had been debilitated during the 2004 to 2006 coup d'etat. In the lead up to that coup d'etat in Haiti against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the U.S. had pressured the American Development Bank to curtail the disbursement of money that had already been approved for was in part under the Clinton administration, in part. So this simply shows that this was in the lead up to in the year 2000, prior to the 2000 election. The Clinton administration of Bill Clinton in his final years started to put the squeeze on Haiti as it became clear that President Aristide's party was coming back to power. And again, one of these policies was to cut off the sanitation funding, something that's rarely pointed out except in journals like Haiti Liberté. So this is the beginning of how the Clintons played a role. But afterwards, as you point out, they used, I could say, the increase in the emergency in Haiti with the emergence of cholera to money worldwide for Haiti. But where did that money go? It went to build luxury hotels, as we pointed out on this program previously. It went to build sweatshops up in the north of Haiti, far, far from the earthquake zone in Port-au-Prince. And so in a way, as you point out, they used the outbreak of cholera not to put blame on the UN where it belonged, but rather just to get money to build these luxury hotels and sweatshops.
Brian Concannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti will join us shortly. But I wanted to get from your sense, your perspective, you're in Haiti all the time, you have your finger on the pulse of what's happening. Was there a sense that people just were left to die and hopefully this thing will just kind of miraculously go away? But we need not get too excited about it because they're accustomed to suffering and dying.
Well, exactly. There's, I could say, an overwhelming tendency of Haiti, countries who are...
We're hearing a little static on... We're getting some static on your end. But go ahead. We just continue.
Some static. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm possibly maybe a result of the Wi-Fi connection I have. But the international community has tried to explain away the problems in their responses in Haiti as saying Haiti is what it is. This is true not just in the cholera, but we look in the political travails that Haiti has gone through in the past year, where its presidential and parliamentary elections were completely fraudulent and plagued by violence. And this was really a result of the U.S., French, Canadian, and other allied countries meddling in elections. And when everything went bad, they said, well, it's Haiti. What can you expect? Well, a lot better than that. And the same thing is true for her. It's as if this raging cholera epidemic was just sort of a fait divers, as they say in French, some sort of miscellaneous news. And one other thing I'd like to say, Utrice, is that their response to it was really to make money. You see this push to promote vaccines, a vaccine which is completely absurd in the case of a bacterially spread disease like cholera. This is just a moneymaker for some of the companies that make these vaccines and get, you know, money from them. There's one company in particular called Sankol, which is making a mint off of this. So It ends up being a way for profit off of the Haitian people's problems.
So internally, what is Haiti's response? It still is an independent country. It still has a government. Things are going not too well, but it still has the ability to advocate for itself, the ability to lobby in its interests on the world stage. It still has the ability to call attention to this travesty that has cost all these many lives, thousands, 10,000 people, 10,000 people dead, 800,000 affected. This is a massive humanitarian problem. Do you think that Haiti got the hearing and the kind of help that it needed?
Well, no, of course not. In fact, one of the problems, Utrice, is that the government that was at the helm of Haiti from during the bulk of this cholera crisis was the government of former President Michel Martelly, who came into power in May of 2011 and left just in February of this past year. And essentially, they did next to nothing to advocate on behalf of Haiti to support, say, the organization Justice and Democracy in Haiti, who was in this camp in the New York courts to hold the UN accountable. So essentially, it's been in the recent months that possibility that there will be more proactive role of the Haitian government. I don't know that they've had an official response till now. I haven't seen it. If it's come out, maybe Brian may know. But essentially, Haiti's response was sit down in the public and match $2 billion response to build sanitation systems. It would be very easy. Haiti building sanitation systems is key. I mean, that's how the European countries, of course, cholera was discovered, we could say, in England back in the 19th century, and they discovered what you have to do is you got to separate the place where you drink from the place where you poop, and they managed to do this. Now the UN took over this proposal that was formulated by Haiti and Dominican Republic, called it their own, but how much money have they raised for this $2.2 billion project? $18 million, not even a tenth. So this shows you how lame the UN response has been, how lame the U.S. response has been, and I think the Haitian government should take a much more aggressive role in demanding that these countries be held responsible.
Well, thanks so much, Kim, for this update. I know that to be suffering under uneven Wi-Fi, but you know, you're a trooper, and I appreciate that so much. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we will be following this up, of course, in your other reports yet to come. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Yutris. Thank you.
Well, the UN's six-year negation of responsibility did not go unchallenged. Brian Concannon and the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which he directs, are among a small group, but formidable group, pushing hard for legal redress for Haiti's cholera victims under international law. Brian Concannon joins us now, and we're talking about what happens now with the UN's grudging admission, partial admission of guilt. Thanks, Brian, for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's odd. The last time we spoke, you were actually in the United Nations on the same issue, pressing for redress. What is the technical issue here that you think prevented the United Nations from acting honorably much earlier than now?
There was never a technical issue that prevented the UN from acting honorably. The reason the UN did not act honorably or legally was that it felt it could get away with doing a lot less. I'm not sure that the, as you described it, the belated partial admission gives us much faith that the UN is really going to act honorably at this point, but it's a step in the right direction, and I think it gives us an opportunity to continue to advocate. It's pretty clear from the timing of this announcement, 6 months later, at a point where a major critical report was about to come out, and in the wake of pressure from member states, the U.S. Congress, others, that the U.N. got to this point, which is a step forward, but got to it kicking and screaming. And it's pretty clear that the U.N. is going to be kicking and screaming all along, and that what needs to happen is enough pressure done to make the U.N. feel that it does have to respond in a way that respects the victims' rights.
Is it that Ban Ki-moon, who resigns later this year, believes, well, his term ends, does not want this attached to his tenure? Is it that it may be setting a precedent if the United Nations were to concede that it has a responsibility now in terms of compensation for victims that it would have brought unto itself by virtue of neglect, just plain neglect? It had brought a huge and costly consequence to itself, which, of course, will have to be funded. Or is it just that,
I think part of it is that the Secretary General is worried that this is going to be his legacy. I don't think the last week's announcement is going to change that. I think that unless the UN does meaningful and quick response that really does control cholera in Haiti and really does give the victims justice, that this is going to be his legacy. I don't think that the fear of a precedent is a legitimate concern. I know that's what the UN keeps saying, but they in UN documents and international treaties, in statements from the Secretary General, from the General Assembly, for 60 years, the UN has acknowledged that it has an obligation to compensate people harmed by its operations. So it doesn't, the UN responding justly to the cholera epidemic does not change the precedent. It actually just complies UN practice with the precedent and the rule of law. But I think in terms of the timing, I think really the most likely factors are just that the pressure has become too great for the UN to ignore. It's just too obvious to too many people that the UN is flouting the very principles of human rights and the rule of law that it is designed to uphold. And I think it's probably harder for the UN to operate. I think it's harder to raise money as long as it's continuing to violate the rights of the cholera victims.
Well, the United States Nations, nonetheless, has been very successful in defying justice, actually, under this idea that it has total immunity in such cases. How is it that you and other groups were finally able to convince the United Nations or any international body that as a defense, just doesn't hold water anymore?
The UN's response to wrongdoing has always been deny and delay. And I think that has worked always in the past because the victims of UN peacekeeping operations are almost by definition poor people living in vulnerable societies. That's where peacekeeping missions go. They're not going to Greenwich. And because the people, the victims, were particularly disempowered and were in places that were hard to reach, when the UN did do something wrong, there'd be a few stories in the paper, and the UN would create some commission to handle it, and then eventually would go away. I think that the rules have changed, especially in the last 10 years, and the UN is just figuring out that that's the case. The reason why the cholera justice initiative has gotten this far, it's because there's been, first of all, the victims' voices have been able to reach the United States and other places where power is exerted, and that's through the work of many journalists, Kim Ives and many other people, mainstream journalists, alternative journalists. It's also been through social media and other ways. It's been on the radar screens, and there's just been a whole campaign, a networked campaign that was not possible 10 years ago before you had social media and network advocacy techniques, that those techniques made this mobilization possible. And because the rules have changed, the UN is now, for the cholera epidemic, and I think from here on, another big issue where the same thing is happening is on sexual assault by peacekeepers. It's just in 2016, the UN can no longer delay and deny if there's a persistent movement to force it to respond justly.
In the statement that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made, do you find that there is still enough of a resistance to worry you about how this eventually will work out?
There's enough in there in the sense that they don't even admit, they admit they were involved in the arrival of cholera, when for 5 years there's been no scientific dispute that they in fact brought cholera, and the steps, they promised to take significant steps without saying what they are. From those two things, it's fairly clear to me that the UN does not have a current intention of responding in an adequate way. The UN has an intention of doing the exact minimum it thinks it can get away with. And I think that our work and the work of all the other people that are fighting for justice for the victims is to make sure that what the UN can get away with is commensurate with the victims' rights. And it's not going to happen without a lot of struggle. You mentioned that we spoke several years ago about this. We're prepared to keep fighting for several years more, as long as it takes. And I think it is going to take some time. I think in the end, the result is going to be just. It's going to save thousands of lives a year. It's going to make fundamental transformations in Haitian society. But we're not going to get there without a lot more fighting.
I was curious about why this case still remains within the purview, it seems, of the United Nations, who is the offender here, and not within some other venue, like an international court or The Hague or someplace where the offender is not also dictating the terms of justice. How did that come to be?
Well, the international legal system is set up by states, and there's all sorts of limitations on how just that system is. And there, based on our research, we've been unable to find any kind of international forum that would take this case and issue a binding decision. And so where we filed a case in the U.S. courts. We first filed an internal claim within the U.N. Then we filed in the U.S. courts. We're going to keep fighting in whatever forum we can. We might appeal to the Supreme Court. We might fight in Haitian courts. We might fight in European courts. We're trying to work that out now. But probably where the UN is losing pretty badly, I mean, it's winning technically in the U.S. courts, but it's losing very badly in the court of public opinion, which I think in the end is probably going to be the most powerful court. I think the UN got to this point because it was, from a public relations standpoint, no longer tenable for them to continue to deny responsibility, and they had to promise to do something. And I think it's going to be the pressure from the public and from civil society that's going to force continued progress.
Okay, so there is, although, not as enthusiastic as you had hoped, but there is some admission of guilt. What now are the legal steps that would end up with the victims being compensated for their suffering and, of course, their families for their deaths?
And so what we're asking for is three things. One is an apology, which still has not happened. The second is compensation for the victims. And the third is the water and sanitation that you need to stop cholera. As Kim mentioned, this is basically 19th century solutions that we're trying to get installed. And in terms of the legal, you know, we don't need to win a lawsuit. If the UN decides on its own accord to respond justly, to do those three things, we don't need to keep fighting in court. But until the UN does that, we are going to keep fighting in court. And where we are right now in the U.S. lawsuit is that on last week, the Court of Appeals dismissed our appeal, which was based on we were appealing a district court's dismissal of the case. So right now we have two courts that have ruled against us, saying that the UN's immunity prevents us from filing a suit. One of the things we're considering now is an appeal to the Supreme Court. We don't have to decide that for 90 days, and the UN has promised more details on its plan for 60 days. So we'll make the Supreme Court decision based on both the legal analysis, but also the factual analysis. Is the UN likely to do something that's going to vindicate the victims' rights? If we decide not to proceed in the U.S., we have options of filing in Haiti and in Europe if that's necessary to get the UN to respond justly.
Well, the UN says that there will be something of a plan of redress that will be issued within a month. What do you expect that might be?
We don't have any indication other than if you look at the last 6 years of the history of this, that everything the UN has done has been inadequate. So we're expecting that it will not rise to a fair response. We'd certainly like to see that, and the UN has an opportunity to step up. But we're assuming that we're going to have to fight to make up the difference between what the UN announces and what it is legally obligated to do.
I want to ask an obvious question. At least it's obvious to me. This is 6 years now. The impact of the introduction of cholera has been devastating. It cannot be denied. And yet it just has been just stewing. Nobody's really getting any resolution here. Do you believe that in part the reaction of the United Nations here is not just self-defense and, you know, just self-protection, that it does not want to incur for Ban Ki-moon a legacy problem or an expense problem for the United Nations in terms of compensation for victims, but the operative idea that, look, this is Haiti. They're accustomed to suffering. We mourn the loss, but it was unintended, and we just have to move on beyond this point. We recognize that it's very sad. We recognize the enormous impact it has had, but we weren't and we aren't really to be accountable for things that are totally beyond our control. And even so, this is Haiti. I keep coming back to this expression. This is Haiti. Why all the fuss? I get that feeling all the time when we talk about Haiti. The idea, it's racist, of course, but the idea that, look, they're accustomed to suffering, and this is just one more aspect of their suffering, and they can deal with it. So why are you upset?
I think that's certainly part of the dynamic, that Haiti, and this goes, you know, this is a factor in throughout the history of MINUSTAH over the last 20 years, is that different standards are allowable because it's Haiti. And just as one illustration of that is that even after cholera broke out in 2010, even after it had been beyond a doubt proven by genetic testing that the UN brought cholera to Haiti, up until as recently as 2015, the UN was dumping its waste directly into the Haitian environment. A report came out 2 weeks ago. It was an internal investigative report that was excoriating the mission for not changing filters when it was supposed to, for leaking waste directly in. And here, this is in 2015, 5 years after an epidemic, 10 to 20,000 deaths later, and the UN still couldn't be bothered to change the filters on its septic systems or find a way to not pipe waste directly into the river. That's inconceivable in New York. It's inconceivable in France, in Britain. I think it's only conceivable in places where people are have darker skin. And, you know, I think you're right that there's no way of explaining MINUSTAH's presence from the beginning, but also its reaction to cholera without bringing in race.
For you as an attorney, what's new about the approaches that you have to take or in handling a case like this? What do you have to do now that you never expected that you have to do in the pursuit of justice here?
I think that from the beginning, we looked at this case in terms similar to the fight against desegregation in schools in the U.S. That had a big step forward with Brown versus Board of Education. And it was clear from that example that to do change through the law, that lawsuits are important, but that they're not sufficient, that you need much more. You need political changes, you need mobilization, you need scholarly advances. And we always knew that that was going to be the case with this. We were somewhat surprised at how well, we're pleasantly surprised at how many people have joined in. And we've had everybody from, you know, journalists to filmmakers, political leaders, activists, you know, lawyers, doctors, public health people. I mean, it's really been exciting how many people have been pushing this. And a lot of what we're doing in terms of our day-to-day work is kind of curating or nurturing this network of people that are all pitching in. And that's, you know, it's different than we expected. It's exciting, though, to have so many people working on this. There's a Haitian proverb, "Men en pile chai pa lu," many hands makes the load light. And that has really been the key to success for us getting this far. It will be the key to success in us getting justice eventually. And it's just been, you know, it's been a surprise, but a very pleasant surprise at how well this network has been able to develop.
All said, though, are we necessarily avoiding the G word, genocide, here? Is there a reason that we're tiptoeing around it?
You know, from a sort of a legal formalistic reading, genocide is an intentional crime. You have to, you have to intend to, you know, to eliminate. Certainly, you know, the amount of people killed by cholera is getting up there, and I think that could be, you could have a genocide with the amounts killed, which are looking now like they're 10 to probably 30,000 people. And at some point, there's not a moral distinction between the recklessness that happened and intentional. But I think as kind of a strict legal interpretation, it's probably not genocide, but a lot of people have said things like genocide like or tantamount to genocide. And I think when you look at the numbers of people killed and the obvious disdain for human life that's been shown right up through the present, because if the UN had responded better to cholera, fewer people would be dying now, and people are dying today. They died yesterday, they'll die tomorrow. That certainly, I can understand why people are calling it tantamount to a genocide.
The outbreak of cholera, especially, of course, in the aftermath of this earthquake in 2010, attracted the attention and the person who the Clintons, and Bill Clinton emerged as essentially the leader of the rebuilding effort, and lots of money was directed toward rebuilding in Haiti. Do you see any way of also considering the Clinton Foundation also as an accessory to this problem? They have the Clinton Global Initiative, which gathers heads of state and people from all over the world who are in a position to get things done. How do we explain the fact that this foundation, with as much money as it has gotten to undertake these different initiatives, still ended up apparently not able to intercede in what is clearly a catastrophe?
Yeah, the Clinton administration and President Clinton himself have certainly failed to show up as part of the solution in important ways that they could. President Clinton did make, when he was still UN Special Envoy to Haiti, he did make a statement appearing to concede that the UN was responsible. But other than that, there's been no public leadership on this issue, which is curious considering the fact that he has taken public stances on a whole range of other issues, from whether President Martelly was doing a good job to the Haitian government's economic policy, but he hasn't spoken out in favor of justice for the cholera victims. I don't know in terms of the Clinton Foundation whether they've done something on cholera. Lots of people, including USAID, including the UN, will tout the work that they're doing on providing clean water or treating water, providing health care. And certainly all those things are saving lives, but just as certainly they're not providing a systemic solution to the cholera crisis. And I think that there is an opportunity for President Clinton to step up and advocate on cholera. I think there's an opportunity for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to step up and advocate for a better response to cholera. And to this date, they have not taken those opportunities, as far as I know.
Especially considering that Hillary Clinton personally selected the president of Haiti and saw to it that he was elected and installed. All right. So,
and those aren't unrelated. I mean, the fact that President Martelly, long after the UN had stopped denying that it was responsible, President Martelly still kept saying there's no evidence that the UN is responsible, which is just patently false. And he knew it was patently false. But part of the reason why he was not able to represent his citizens in this was that he was more beholden to the international community than he was to the Haitian people. And which was part of the whole design. That was part of why he was placed in power, was that he would be influenceable. And part of that influence was that the international community did get him to not tell the truth about cholera.
Could you tell us, as you prepare now for the next leg of this problem legally, what exactly are you doing now, and what will likely happen, especially to those looking to you, organizations like yours, for some kind of relief and justice?
We're responding on multiple fronts. On the legal front, we're now studying what our next options are with the U.S. case. At the same time, we're working on options for both European countries and for Haiti. So we're still full speed ahead on the legal front, and we'll continue to be until the U.N. responds justly. We're also working with victims on the ground in Haiti who are doing a whole range of advocacy initiatives. There was a press conference around noontime today in Port-au-Prince to launch some of those, and there'll be much more coming out in the future. We're also working with members of Congress who've expressed interest, and so back in June, 159 members of the House, including both Republicans and Democrats, urged a better response, and in July, two senators do. And we'll keep working with members of Congress to increase that support. We're also working with a whole range of organizations and member states that are applying pressure directly on the UN. We're making sure that cholera is part of the debate over the next Secretary General. And one of the exciting developments that I think had a factor in the recent announcement was that over half of the candidates for Secretary General have called for the UN to respond better on cholera. And we're going to continue to work that avenue as well as anything else we can to advance the cause of justice, whether it be in the national court or the court of public opinion.
Is there any new ground that you are breaking here in the field of law as you manage this case?
That's a very interesting question because on one hand, the law is settled. From a technical view, the law is settled. The UN has an obligation to compensate people hurt by its operations. And so, in principle, nothing we're doing is not clearly within the law. What's different is we're actually enforcing that law because the UN has always been able to get away with, whether it's Haiti cholera, whether it's sexual assaults, whether it's sighting of refugee camps in Kosovo on areas contaminated by heavy metals, the UN has always been able to say, even when it can't deny that it caused the harm, even when it can't deny that it has a legal obligation to compensate, it's always said, well, nobody can make us comply with these uncontestable legal obligations. And what we're trying to do is to establish that, yes, the UN does have to comply, and somebody can make the UN comply with these legal obligations.
Well, a very, very enlightening discussion today with you, Brian. Thank you so much for being with us. And we will certainly follow up to see where this goes. We'll wait and see what the so-called statement from the United Nations will be within a month. And hopefully, even before then, there will be some indication that there is a sincere effort to try and get this matter resolved. But thank you for your work, and thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for covering this, and I would encourage you to continue to apply the same level of coverage, and I'll look forward to talking to you at the next step.
All right. Thanks again. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I keep saying we have a ready reference point for all kinds of things right in our midst, and it's Haiti. And when we look at what's happening with Haiti, how people are regarding Haiti and treating Haiti, the huge international interest in Haiti, and not necessarily a good or a beneficial interest, you see the instruction is right there as to what it is we need to do. And we can't operate on this. I'm getting feedback here. And we have to be supportive. We have to be supportive, but we also have to be alert and arrive at a point of clarity with the information. And that's what we're trying to do here on Lead Stories and at PRN. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs. I almost reversed the order there. Thank you for listening. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye. Thank you.